This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Later I'll be talking with NASA scientist Matt Rodell about a new map of future Earth in a changed climate. But first this. Are you already experiencing extreme climate change? We are. Around here, the new greatest record flood ever was just subsiding from homes and downtown streets when the wildfires began. We had 90-degree heat in May, 32 degrees C in Canada, and in the last few days, mosquitoes have driven everyone inside, and we don't get mosquitoes here normally. Listeners in the American Midwest, the East Coast, and people around the world know what I'm talking about. We're getting worn down, and the real impacts of climate change are still ahead. So why are world leaders still talking about 1.5 degrees C global warming as though that was still possible? Why is the American government calling it a hoax? Why isn't the media warning everyone every day? I've got too many questions that I can't answer, so I've called up a lifeline. Michael Mielke calls himself a cultural transformation engineer. Earlier in his career, Michael led a movement to get tens of thousands of kids moved from state care to real families. He was the executive director for a movement that became the Coastal Wetlands Planning, Protection, and Restoration Act, and that helped Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, and it was passed by Congress. Now Michael Mielke has teamed up with visual artist and post-carbon Salt Lake founder Gene Arnold. They are on a quest to get billions of dollars invested for the great emergency of our time, climate change, and the environment. Their organization is called the Association for the Tree of Life, or ATL, based in the great state of Utah. Michael, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
8 years ago, in 2010, you introduced six professors from Brigham Young University. That press conference was to explain that global warming was real and not a hoax or a conspiracy. Why was that needed then, and has climate awareness improved in Utah?
Difficult question, Alex. I think that the climate awareness in Utah has improved. However, dominatingly still, we're the reddest state in the U.S., and it is politically inappropriate to state that you don't believe that we're not going to be able to continue doing what we're doing, and that, or to say that climate change is real. This is just the giant political and cultural divide in our nation. Utah exhibits it to the most extent, I think.
Well, at that time, I think Bill 12 was going to say that climate change was not real, that it was just a conspiracy, and it was going to be a bill passed in the legislature there.
It was a concurrent resolution. It did pass. Then recently this year, the legislature passed a concurrent resolution that said we would do something about climate change as long as it didn't interfere with the economy.
Okay, so Radio EcoShock has listeners all over the world, as you know, and many of them are either trying to recover from the last once-in-500-year emergency or fearing the next one. Are your contacts mirroring back that kind of concern about climate?
Our contacts are either in despair and resignation or more desperate. We connect with, and our association, you know, has ranged from 20,000 to 40,000 individuals and organizations over time. And that group is either in despair and resignation or desperation. So they communicate back that, so the answer to the question of what time is it, is now it's time that we have to quit talking about particular parts of the climate or ecological overshoot and figure out how can we actually do something and awaken people, including those in Utah.
Well, we are going to get to that. I would like to hear first, though, about the event that you had planned with Kevin Anderson, the Let's Get Real climate scientist from the Tyndall Center in the UK. It didn't happen, but what was planned?
Before the election, in July of the presidential election year, a person by the name of Russell Green, part of our group, had, with Bernie Sanders' help, put into the Democratic platform a call for a climate summit. That summit was to happen in the first 100 days of Hillary Clinton's administration. My role as part of the group, was in looking for and finding who would be the lead climate scientist for such a climate summit. And you can read it in the Democratic platform still. It called on the U.S. to mobilize for climate stability. It was a real World War II type of mobilization call. This was in the Democratic platform. Few people know that, but that was what was there. Kevin Anderson agreed to be our lead scientist for the climate summit that was to happen should Hillary have won. Hillary allowed this to be in the Democratic platform, but it was pushed and moved by Bernie Sanders, who during the campaign twice mentioned climate mobilization. So this was just about 2 years ago when that effort happened, and then, of course, it fell apart, and many of our team fell apart after the election.
Wow, what an opportunity missed. I know that Professor Anderson also calls out the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the Paris Accord because they depend on a delusion to save us from this extreme climate shift. What is that delusion, Michael, that's involved, say, with burning biomass and then capturing the carbon? What are they thinking will happen?
You know, we call it in our publications the Tinkerbell effect. It's like believing some miracle is going to happen, and because you believe it, which happens in the play Peter Pan, you know, Tinkerbell comes back to life because the audience is asked to believe. And so they all applaud, and Tinkerbell comes back to life. We call it the Tinkerbell delusion. And it's that somehow, after we've gone way past 2 degrees in terms of the climate CO2 in the atmosphere, that we can somehow suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere by growing agricultural grass that's twice the size of India every year, twice a year, grow that grass, cultivate it, bring it to power plants, burn it, capture the CO2, pump it somewhere, however many miles needs to be pumped, bury it in the ground and hope it stays there forever, because if CO2 gets out, then it's poisonous to people. So the delusion is that we have any way we can possibly do that, because we don't have the arable land in the world of two Indias, period. That means taking all the arable land we have now growing food and using it to grow grass so we can capture the CO2 from burning it, and then doing it all with net zero. In other words, using no fossil fuels at all to cause this to happen. It's not only a delusion, there's nothing like that that exists. There's no model to go to. It's an idea still on the drawing table. It's basically a let's all live on Mars kind of idea, meaning it's totally, I would say, impossible. I don't think Kevin uses that term. He says it's a moral hazard. But essentially, it's a way we can continue doing what we're doing and think that somehow we're going to fix it after we've already let the horse out of the barn.
Well, it's right up there with aliens coming to save us or Jesus coming to save us in time. But the trouble is that it is built right into the Intergovernmental Panel's predictions of the path that we're on. It's built right into the Paris Accord. It's built right into some government programs. So we're just living with this delusion, and it's very dangerous. It prevents us from really doing what we need to do.
Alex, if I could have an effect, it would be for people to see, people on our side, and I'm going to put you on our side, people who are just will do what's necessary or want to do what's necessary in order to stabilize climate at or below 2 degrees. So all of us on our side, the green movement, the big green here, this is the group that needs to see that we are banking on this delusion, because I don't think most people know this. It's not something that's widely known, which is why with our publications and calling out the delusion and talking about the Tinkerbell effect, we're trying to get our side to see the delusion that it is operating on. That's the good guys.
In May 2018, you and the Association for the Tree of Life released that new ebook titled Climate and Ecological Delusions and Contradictions That Will Rapidly End Humanity... unless... Do you think it's possible that without emergency action, humans could destroy the environment to the point of our own extinction?
I don't think that's a question, because the vast majority of people that I talk to believe that's a reality, that not only with climate, but with the various ecological overshoots that we live within, that, yes, we could end humanity. And this goes back dozens of years, I mean, at least two dozen years, when I first had the great scientist that we talk to from time to time say, you know, we can eliminate humanity. This goes back to some of the early 1990s things that scientists were saying, like Paul Ehrlich and James Hansen and various other people were talking about 6 degrees centigrade and that humanity couldn't survive that. So yes, without emergency action, I think it's very likely that we could end humanity. I mean, if you say, okay, would that mean all of us are extinct, or would we have 100,000 people left, or would we have even 100 million left? The point is, that's a ridiculous way of looking at it, because would any of those people, let's say there were 100 million left, would they want to be living in the devastated world that would be left with 99% of us dying by the ravages that we're making and we're enduring right now in the way we treat the earth and the way we treat our living systems?
Okay, so in this ebook, which is free to anyone online, you do propose a way forward with some action suggestions, but I think the first step, and you handle this well, I think, in the ebook, is that we have to be honest that in many ways we've already failed. And I share that sense of failure. Despite 12 years of broadcasting serious climate warnings direct from scientists who have the facts, humans just added more greenhouse gas pollution to the atmosphere in 2017, not less. Our rate of increase is growing. So how big is that failure, and where are some of the places where it's coming from?
Gosh, how big is that failure? There's not really a vocabulary to talk about how big the failure is. I would say at its core is a failure to understand the importance of the living systems which we are destroying. So the failure, you know, I understand the failure when it comes just to the climate question. You know, there's been an incredibly gigantic organized campaign to mislead and confuse the public, and we know how that's happened and why it's happened. So that campaign is out there, and it's become politically necessary for the dominant political party to maintain that fiction. And I believe they know it's a fiction. Nonetheless, it's a fiction so that we can continue, as you said, to add to and increase our global warming pollution. We're not only not diminishing, which is absolutely necessary, we're still increasing. So the failure is a failure to understand what it would take for us to be able to have a future. So the failure, what I call it in the ebook, is a gluttonous and greedy devouring. It's our consumption system. It's our devouring of our living systems and not seeing it, because in each particular place that we operate, we can't see. We sweep under the rug what are the poisons and pollutions. Our sinks are filling up, as you know. Global warming is invisible, can't be seen, can't be smelled, can't be tasted. So we're conveniently, purposefully ignoring what we're doing. And when I say, what time is it? I think the time for, you know, the analysis and the diagnosis is over. And I think more and more, and I think now is the time, more and more people contact me, scientists, people on our side. It's, we've got to do something. We can't maintain the fiction that we can continue anything like what we're doing in our economic and political systems and still have any kind of future for the kids, period.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest is Michael Mielke, president of the board of the Association for the Tree of Life. We're talking about their new ebook and the movement in it to raise public consciousness and action about our worldwide climate and ecological emergency. Michael, you have a partner or work person with you at ATL, the visual artist Jean Arnold, and she was a co-founder or possibly the founder of Post Carbon Salt Lake. Where does the Post Carbon Institute fit into all this?
We have had a long relationship with Post Carbon, which really was something started by Richard Heinberg, and now it operates significantly on the resilience.org website. And our relationship with Richard and his work basically was the root of our founding post-carbon, and we've continued that relationship over the years. And people can find Richard's work at resilience.org.
Michael, European countries are making more progress installing alternative energy. Denmark's become a major wind producer. Germany and France subsidize solar installations on homes and farms and business. Can the alternative energy revolution, if that ever comes, be enough to save this problem that we've got?
Really glad you asked that question, Alex, because I believe that many people on our side, many green groups, even big green in our country, is trumpeting the idea that we can simply substitute wind and solar and hydro for the world we have and keep going with the economic system we have. And there are a lot of great books, including one that Richard Heinberg did write that's free on his site, and we mention it in our book. I believe it's definitive, and he takes a look at whether renewables can displace what we are using now in fossil fuels, which is still over 80% of our energy source. Can we go to renewables and have this world? Answer, no. Can't happen. So that what world we have now is going to have to enter into a phase of collective constraint. We will have less energy, less material resources in the future if we want to have a future. So there's no way we can plausibly substitute renewable energy for fossil fuel energy. We will have to not only ditch fossil fuel energy, for sure, but have a design and build a completely different, much more constrained, much less consuming world so that the grandchildren have any world to live in at all.
All right. We're loaded up with deadly threats. We didn't even talk about nuclear power plants or weapons and war and the spread of disease. Oh, my. But at least your new book has a starting way out, and it's not widely considered. We look at the failures of governments and corporate world and even well-meaning environmental groups to move the public. There doesn't seem to leave anyone with enough economic power to bring change. Who do you suggest?
Well, I think there's only one entity, and I'd like for somebody to give me any other possibility. We're at the end. We're at the end of our rope. We face a wall we're going to run into. Clearly, our political system is broken. It's not going to help us. Clearly, our economic system is in a runaway overconsumption. There's no way out through a better economic system. The only entity that we can reach for is that entity that is designed to help us in our hour of need, that entity that loves humanity. It's called philanthropy. Now, philanthropy has its own problems. They are still caught in a lot of the delusion of we can fix this with the Bloomberg and Brown point of view, Michael Bloomberg and Jerry Brown, the city and state effort, which is clearly not going to get anywhere close to what we need. And Big Green needs to see this. It's still deluded on what it can do. And philanthropy is still supporting a lot of these minor efforts, which are not going to deal with the problem. So what we propose is for people to understand what the problem is, which we explain in our short article and in our ebook and in our film. It's a 4-minute film. And in that, to call on philanthropy to devote hundreds of millions of dollars to an awakening, an alarm, a general alarm for the public to understand we've got to change our social, political, moral, and economic systems. We call it ESPM. ESP is easy to remember. Economic, social, political, and moral systems have to change if we're going to have a future. And no one can do this. It's gigantic. No one has the personnel or the financial resources to do this except philanthropy. So individuals, we propose, call on philanthropy to do this. And in our book, in our appendix, we make it very clear and simple, and people can take 1 or 2 minutes and actually call on philanthropy to help awaken. So those people who care, those people who get this, those people who see what's going on, they can, in a very few minutes, respond by calling on philanthropy. We make it very easy in the end of our little short ebook.
It's my understanding, Michael, that Warren Buffett directed most of his big multi-billion-dollar fortune to the control of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They're working together, and Bill has talked about climate change more in recent years, but has not funded major initiatives to save the climate, as far as I know. And in fact, he's still talking about nuclear plants as a way to do it. I mean, what good is it going to do to save millions of lives with vaccinations when crops die off due to heat, flood, or drought? Climate is the mother of us all. What have you heard about the Gates Foundation and climate change?
Well, we actually appealed to them several years ago and got the response back from them saying, we don't do this. But I think the real key to Bill Gates was his February 2010 TED Talk, which is called Innovating to Zero. And here's the nub, and I think this is the nub for philanthropy too, because Gates there says, this is 8.5 years ago, he says, we've got to get to zero carbon dioxide. Zero. It's why calling it Innovating to Zero. That's what we have to do. There's no other way out. And he calls for energy miracles. What is important, and that's why we include Bill Gates in the Gates Foundation in our appeal, because Bill is still saying, as he said 8.5 years ago, we need energy miracles. Nothing's come along. His nuclear program is not even close to being able to be demonstrated, much less displayed and then placed all over the world. So if he understands we've got very little time, which he says he does, if he understands we have to get rid of carbon dioxide, which comes from fossil fuels, obviously, and if he says we need miracles to get there, and we don't have any except, you know, the miracle that's in the delusion system of the Paris Agreement, as you've already said, that's where we've got to get philanthropy and Bill Gates in particular, the Gates Foundation, to understand that what they're doing is trivial when they're trying to do vaccinations, et cetera, when the world is going to fall apart from the larger factor. And in our 4-minute film, which is linked in our book, it's linked in our short article, it will be linked in whatever you publish, Alex, people can see that. We have Catherine Hayhoe, who is a famous climate scientist who won the Steven Schneider Award this year. She stars in our little 4-minute film explaining that if philanthropy doesn't fund this, the climate and ecological problem, then it's wasting its time. So we should have 100,000 people send that little film to the Gates Foundation so they can see that what they're doing is missing the boat.
Yeah, as part of your book, ATL has that video with Catherine Hayhoe, who is a Republican climate scientist, I might add, and she has spoken to religious groups, and also the Reverend Michael Dowd, who calls himself a pro-future evangelist. Why the religious speakers in your video?
Well, in our work, when we basically did 20-something years ago the national legislation for the wetlands, which was the largest restoration on the planet, and we were building the national movement, the most interested groups in hearing our message, the moral message of what needs to happen, were churches and religious groups. And I have, for the last 30 years, continued to be involved with churches and religious groups, because this is where people come together and at least discuss something that's not about what I'm going to buy tomorrow. You know, they at least consider the questions of justice. They consider the questions of what do we need to do collectively. This is where that kind of conversation can happen. So we will stay connected with churches and religious groups, and that's why Michael Dowd, as you mentioned, Reverend Reality, is part of our association and part of our mission.
When it comes to fossil fuels, people are just buying more and more gas-powered gizmos, even though the polls say they have a vague awareness of climate change. We are addicts, and there's no rehab. Will we need fossil consumer rehab centers as part of this plan?
In our book, we consider that question, that basically people, when they're confronted with the level of change that's required, the massive, complete reconstruction of our systems we operate within, the collapse of a person's worldview, because our worldview is about continuing to consume and what we're going to have tomorrow and what we're doing on Facebook, which, you know, is to me completely insane while we watch the world disintegrate. So when people's worldview is collapsed, yes, people will need emotional, psychological help and support. You know, when they see the addiction, my background is psychology, clinical psychology is my field. And addicts need to hit bottom. Addicts need to be confronted with their addiction. Addicts need to see the destruction that they are doing in what they're doing. But when that happens, then they need some kind of program that they can go to for rehabilitation. And that doesn't mean, you know, like institutions or drug treatment centers. I mean, Alcohol Anonymous is a treatment. People need support groups. They need psychological intervention. Yes, yes, we will all need that. I need it. People in ATL need it. We live in this crazy society, and we have to constantly, we confront ourselves with our own contradictions just in what our lifestyle is. So, yes, it will be necessary.
But what do you see happening if the public in developed nations do get the warning and they're finally ready for real action? Then what?
We'll have to reconceptualize what it means to be a citizen. It's got to be different from what George Bush said. When the going gets tough, the tough go shopping. We're in a situation where the going is going to get tough, and we will need to come together cooperatively and generate collective constraint, or the alternative is chaos and violence. We can have an avenue if philanthropy will fund. And here's again, hundreds of millions of dollars are going to be required to fund an interactive, balanced broadcast center where people can have access to best practice on viability, sustainability, and sustaining the planet.
I actually ran into your ebook through a shorter summary of the whole program on a site called MAB, and MAB stands for the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and Biosphere. I ran into that with Dr. Paul Ehrlich, always recommended it to our listeners. So that's one place to start. And did you tell me that that's been republished at resilience.org as well?
Since our book was actually synthesized and finished this month, so the beginning of the month, from the beginning, Paul Ehrlich's team and the Millennial Alliance for the Biosphere and Humanity, MAHB, Humanity and the Biosphere, was a fan. And they adopted the book for their library and published this last week, and will publish again next week, the short article. But what's going on is other people, since with Paul Ehrlich and the Ehrlich team and Stanford's endorsement and mentioning it to people, we've got other organizations and media and publication sites that are picking up the short article and the book itself. And so Resilience, where Richard Heinberg has published extensively, picked it up today. And we expect that this is an idea whose time has come, and since what we need to do is spread the word, we're going to try to make sure it's published and shown and seen and heard in as many places as possible.
And we'll get it out on radio.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
My guest is Michael Mielke. In 1942, when the fascists controlled all of Europe, parts of Africa, the Middle East, and China, and all the way down the Philippines, there was no guarantee of victory at all. And I was thinking, you know, Michael, that if somebody died in 1942, they would have left this world thinking that evil was going to triumph. And frankly, I have the feeling lately that this is going to take decades, this battle, and you and I may pass on without knowing how this story ends. What do you think?
My own view, Alex, and, you know, it's tempered. I'm first of all, you know, I'm going to be 70 this year, and I've been at this battle. You know, Paul Ehrlich was involved in the wetlands legislation kind of tangentially. In 1991, I met Paul at the Stanford bookstore because I was visiting Hewlett Foundation. They had given us a very significant amount of money, and we just got the legislation passed, and I was trying to figure out what the hell do I do with the rest of my life. And so I met Paul, picked up his book, Healing the Earth. He and Ann published that in 91. He was selling it at the bookstore, and we had a, you know, backslapping because the legislation had passed and something good was happening in his view. So I took a walk in Muir Woods, and in front of the UN sign there in Muir Woods, where the UN was founded, the dedication sign, I said, I'm going to give the rest of my life to this. And his first 47 pages or so in his book, which is 300 and something pages, was on climate. That's what he began with in 1991. That's when I decided, you know, I'm going to dive into this as completely as I can. And I had the background, as you know, of that cultural change, you know, both with the kids and with national legislation. Since then, you know, I appeared with Mike Mann, you know, walked the streets with James Hansen. Kevin Anderson is part of our team. I mean, you know all these people. So you know all the people that I have been collaborating with since these 27 years. And, of course, talking to a lot of people. John Englander, you know, the great writer on the floods on Main Street. Michael Dowd came and stayed with us because he was looking for a couple of months. He was looking to generate his program on how he could be part of the warning. Catherine Hayhoe visited here, and that's how we got the film. So you understand the people that I communicate with. And I have not taken, and I don't want to take, a forward position like this is me. You know, I've always been part of this gigantic association because that's the way we had the national legislation, and that's the way we got the state legislations for the trust funds for kids. It's like, you know, this isn't me. It's about how can we build a movement. So I said all that to say, you know, I've been talking with these people for all these years, and I don't believe we've got time. Alex, I think if we do not find a way to awaken people and sound the alarm very soon, I don't think we have a chance. And I mean that. I think we'll blow through boundaries. I mean, the economy to me is holding on with scotch tape. I don't think we'll ever pay this debt back. And of course, what has Canada done lately? Look at what the Prime Minister has done. Look, I mean, it's us and your country are just totally, totally insane. And we're destroying as rapidly as we can. So without some comeuppance, without hitting bottom soon, without some way of seeing what we're doing, that's why the, you know, the little short article and then the background in the book and bringing in the character stepping down from the Sistine Chapel, you know, using Sophia Wisdom, the better angels of our nature, you know, the awareness that is not just the reptilian part of us, that if we cannot awaken that part, if we can't see what we're doing, if we can't have a revolution, if we can't eliminate slavery, you know, if we aren't on the edge of a breakthrough now, I don't think we're going to make it. And that's my genuine, honest opinion, and it's based on all of those people that I talk to every day, all day, you know. Most of them, most of the people that I talk to basically don't think we have a chance. They don't think that anything can happen. You know, if they could see that there's a way for something to happen, if they could see that we need to sound the alarm and that, you know, rather than just saying we're all f***ed, you know, why don't you try to call on the one entity? Take a minute or two instead of giving up, instead of being in resignation. But there's that part in the book, and I don't see this anywhere, and I think this has been something that's a contribution, I'll say this, and that is that what the movement has done has tried to market telling people what to do. We've had a 25-year history of not telling people the truth because we needed to raise money. So we were selling polar bears and selling, you know, 50 simple things to save the earth. So we've consciously not told people what was going on because we're afraid that if we told them, they would freeze. So what we do in the book, which I think is, I will call it a breakthrough, is we say, no, that's entirely wrong. You know, what life shows you is that every capability you have, every sense you have as a human being, sight, smell, taste, feel, all of it, did not happen without enormous struggle, difficulty, pain. So without triggering fear, without triggering reality, without telling people the truth, then when they have that trigger of the fight or flight response, the survival response, what they have to have right then is a way to deal with that, or they freeze. It is true. If you're confronted by the saber tooth and you cannot hit it with a stick or run, you know, you freeze and die. That's what you do. When an animal is attacked by a big cat, it goes into shock. So there's very little pain when an animal's dying, when we're dying. Very little pain. We go into shock. We freeze. What we have to do is trigger the fight or flight response and have people scream at philanthropy and scream at each other rather than giving up. And I think that is the nub. And that's what we try to do in this book, make it very simple for people to scream the alarm. We've got to sound the alarm. We don't have much time. I believe that the people in philanthropy, they are these people I talk to. They are the scientists. They are affiliated. You know, we all know how deep is the crap we're in. We know this. Are we going to just go off the cliff, you know, in our resignation? Or are we going to at least try? You know, what we say is pick life. You know, life has constantly shown its ability to respond and react in a crisis and in pain and in fear. Let's not try to sell people this is going to be a nice future. We have to rise to the occasion like life has over the last 4 billion years. That's our case. That's our breakthrough, Alex.
That was beautiful, and I'm going to put that on the air. Michael Mielke is the president of the board of the Association for the Tree of Life, and Gene Arnold is the vice president. Lawrence Wullersheim, author of Climageddon, the Global Warming Emergency and How to Survive It, is also a board member. I'll put links to the free ebook from ATL, Climate and Ecological Delusions and Contradictions That Will Rapidly End Humanity Unless, and the short summary that you can find at other sites will also be in my show blog at ecoshock.org. You can also go directly to the website at www.tree-of-life.works, www.treeoflife.works. And Michael Mielke, thank you so much for your activism and for sharing this vision with us on Radio EcoShock.
Wonderful to be with you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Maybe it won't be the heat of global warming that undoes us. In the worst-case scenario for this century, new science from NASA suggests it could be how much water is available. Hard data from satellites show big changes have already occurred. And finally, we have enough detail to peer into the future locally, regionally, where you live. We are fortunate to have on the line the lead author of the new paper, Emerging Trends in Global Freshwater Availability, Dr. Matthew Rodell. Matthew is the chief of the Hydrological Sciences Laboratory at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He's an author of over 100 papers in major scientific journals, editor of a journal on hydrometeorology, and I'll ask him what that is later, and a member of the science team for NASA's Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment called GRACE, and that's very important. Matt Rodell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, you're a water guy, and you say changes in available water is the next big thing. Why?
Well, water is vital to life, as you know, and it's also vital to growing crops so we have enough food for a growing population around the world. And what we've seen in our data is that water storage and groundwater storage in particular is changing around the world and often not in the right direction.
You know, 99% of my listeners just turn on a tap and there's the water. But the majority of the people don't have those magic taps and water rights. Matt, how would you characterize world water stress right now?
Well, let me say first that, you know, I feel the same way. I turn my water on. There's clean, clear water every time. But if you look in your kitchen, you'll find that there are fruits and vegetables that were grown in perhaps Southern California or California Central Valley, where the water table has been depleted for the past 50 years. You may find rice from India and wheat and other crops from the central U.S., all regions where groundwater is being depleted in order to be used to irrigate agriculture. So it's being used unsustainably, which means at some point in the future, as those wells dry, it may put a crimp in our ability to grow those foods.
But isn't it natural to have cycles of too much water or too little over the years?
Absolutely. And so that's one of the things that made this work unique, was we had to do our best to separate the natural variability from other causes, things like direct human impacts like groundwater consumption and also climate change impacts that are likely to extend into the future. But we found that, you know, much of the variability is these natural interannual cycles that are associated with things like El Nino, La Nino cycles and that sort of thing.
And the other huge factor, of course, is human behavior. Satellites can't tell you what we will do. How did you factor that into your assessments for each part of the world?
Well, we had to make use of whatever independent data we had. In addition to the GRACE data, which tells us about changes in thrust or water storage, we had information on irrigation intensity, so what parts of the world use a lot of water for irrigating crops. We had information on precipitation changes over the years, so we could say, you know, with some certainty, if we saw a trend in one direction, maybe an increase in water, and there's also an increase in precipitation, it was pretty clear that that increase in precipitation was part of the answer. But the reverse is also true. If precipitation was stable or increasing, and we saw a decrease in the water stored on and in the land, then that means there's had to be some other explanation for the decrease that we saw. So using these independent data sources, along with information from people on the ground and other published reports, helped us to characterize each of the prominent changes that we saw around the world.
So let's check out the real star in this new paper. Please describe for our listeners what the GRACE satellites do and how that enables scientists to measure water that we can't see, that's hidden under the ground.
Yeah, so the GRACE satellites are a fascinating story. Most Earth-observing satellites, and there are a lot of them orbiting the Earth, most of them are looking down and measuring light or microwaves emanating from the surface and using those to infer surface properties. GRACE was completely unique. It was actually two satellites, one following the other, and it was actually feeling Earth's gravity field. And the way it did that was gravity actually varies based on the amount of mass. So if you imagine a mountain range, there's a lot more mass there, and that means there's a slightly greater gravitational potential over that mountain range. The same is true for if you had a big, you know, snowfall or rainfall event. If there's a bunch of snow on the ground, that means there's a lot more mass there, and there's actually more gravitational potential. So if you walked around outside when it was wet versus when it was dry, you wouldn't say, oh, I feel heavier on the wet day. But the water in the soil, in the groundwater, and snow and surface waters is actually enough to perturb the orbits of satellites. So the GRACE satellites were actually monitoring each other and their orbital changes. And over the course of a month, by measuring the precise distance between the two satellites, the satellites were about 200 kilometers apart, and they're measuring that distance down to the micron level, which is about the size of a red blood cell. By monitoring these changes in the distance between the two satellites every 5 seconds over the course of a month, scientists could construct a map of Earth's gravity field. And from month to month, because the measurements are so precise, we can actually see changes in Earth's gravity field that are associated with changes in mass. And that's how we're able to infer changes in the water stored on and in the land surface.
That kind of amazing science makes me feel a little bit better about humans. And there are several surprises in this paper breaking down ideas that we've all come to believe. For example, disappearing Himalayan glaciers were supposed to cut off water for millions of people in India, yet your assessment finds glacier melt may not be the major risk.
Well, in India, there's two stories going on. Northern India, which tends to be pretty dry, it's a semi-arid region, they're pumping huge amounts of water out of their aquifer to irrigate crops. You might not be surprised to know that one of the major crops there is rice. Rice is typically grown in about 3 feet of water, and so when you put 3 feet of water in a dry area, most of it's going to evaporate and be gone. So northern India, we see a huge decrease in groundwater storage, whereas in central and southern India, we've actually seen an increase in recent years, which may be partly natural variability, but there's also a prediction in the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, reports that precipitation may be increasing in southern India over the course of the next century. So it's possible that that climate change impact caused an increase there. That says nothing about the you know, what's going on with the Himalayan glaciers. Most of the glaciers around the world, if not all, are melting away, and we see that in the GRACE data as well.
And again, there have been articles warning China would experience big disturbances in water due to massive dam building like the Three Gorges Project. But it almost seems like this paper says climate-driven changes may actually help the Chinese people get past that.
Well, it's unclear what's going to happen. We're lucky that the GRACE follow-on satellites were just launched this past Tuesday and will extend this important record, you know, another 15 years into the future. At that point, maybe we'll say with more certainty which of these changes are caused by climate change and which ones are likely to continue at what rate. At this point, you know, looking at China, I think one of the big surprises to me in the paper was that you could see this huge increase in terrestrial water storage in central eastern China, where they built a bunch of dams. You've probably heard of the Three Gorges Dam project. But the building of the dams and the filling of reservoirs is so massive that we actually see an increase in terrestrial water storage in the GRACE data. However, other parts of China have experienced a decrease. Their North China Plain, which is in the northeastern part of China where they grow a lot of crops, has been experiencing a large decrease in groundwater caused by irrigated agriculture. And we've seen decreases in northwest China as well.
In 2006, Dr. James Lovelock gave a speech to the Institution of Chemical Engineers in the UK. He just spent some time at the Met Office Hadley Center for Climate Change. At the lecture, Lovelock offered a map which was the best product of the time, I'm sure. It showed wide swaths of land above and below the equator would become deserts around the globe as climate change progressed. Now in 2018, can we say it's not that simple?
Well, it's definitely not that simple. The latest climate model predictions tend to show that the high-latitude regions will experience some slight increase in precipitation over the course of the next century. Of course, that increase will be mostly more rain as opposed to more snow. And then when we look at the drier mid-latitudes, the prediction is a lot of those drier mid-latitudes will become even more dry in the future. But what we've seen so far is that while the GRACE data and the changes in terrestrial water storage over the past 15 years are somewhat consistent with those predictions, 15 years is not nearly enough to confirm those predictions, and we'll need to continue to look at the data in the coming decades.
Right. You'd like to have 100 years of data to be really positive about these things, but we don't have that 100 years. We need this information right now.
That's absolutely true, and I think especially with the regions where we've seen the direct human impacts of groundwater pumping, people need to start to act now, and action means both consumer decisions, you know, what things you buy at the store, and considering how much water they take to produce and maybe where they were produced, and also policy changes. So you can look to a place like Israel where they've been dealing with dry climate forever, and they've done an amazing job at increasing their water use efficiency, growing the right crops, and installing, you know, water-efficient fixtures and houses and all that. And they get the most crop for drop, is what people say. And what they've done could be emulated in other parts of the world.
As you mentioned, on the northern plateau of India, farmers are drilling more and pumping deeper to get water. Will they reach a limit?
Yeah, well, the aquifers are almost anywhere on the earth if you dig deep enough. But yeah, some of them are more productive than others, and over time they can definitely be depleted. You can't just dig deeper and deeper forever. The other thing that happens is as the water level declines in an aquifer, the quality tends to be reduced as well. It tends to be more saline, so you may get to a point where even though there could still be some water left, it's not worth using because the quality is no good. But it doesn't happen all at once. It's not like draining your tub and, you know, one second there's water in there and the next it's gone. What will happen is in the aquifers, the shallower wells will go dry first and people have to dig deeper wells, and maybe the fringe of the aquifer, there will be no more water left. So it'll be sort of a slow decline and a slow death for wells in any given region.
The same groundwater pumping happened in California in the big drought during your study period. In the last couple of years, though, there was a lot more rain and snow and the reservoirs filled. Does the water storage system go back to the way it was?
Not exactly. California is a great example. It's nice because we have more data there than just the 15 years of the GRACE record. There are actually groundwater well observations going back to the 1960s. And when we look at those for what's happened in California's Central Valley aquifer, we see that there's sort of this stair-step decline. There are natural cycles of drought, and then you get a couple years of wet. You know, you may get these atmospheric rivers dumping a whole lot of rain and snow in the region, and the water levels come back up again. But they never come back up to the same level where they were during the last high. And so you sort of get this stair step down where it gets each new drought is drier than the previous drought, and each wet period is not quite as wet in terms of aquifer storage as the previous one was. And that's what we've continued to see during the GRACE record. So even though they got a lot of rain the past couple of years in California, and the aquifers have recovered to some extent, they have not recovered to previous levels and probably never will, because each time an aquifer loses water, it actually compacts and it can't hold as much water the next time. And that's why we've seen massive subsidence, which is when the level of the ground actually goes down over time and it never rebounds completely.
You know, some scientists have suggested climate change helped drive the revolution in Syria as water shortage moved failing farm families right into urban slums. But this paper suggests another factor, dam building in Turkey. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, of course, surface water is a very important resource in many parts of the world. And often, you know, the surface waters originate in the high mountain areas, and then they move down to the shallower areas where people use it more, maybe the drier areas. And if you have surface water moving across an international border and the upstream country is building dams and the downstream country doesn't have as much water to use after those dams are built, of course, that could potentially lead to regional tension. So we hope that as countries consider doing these types of projects, that they work with their neighbors in order to ensure that there's enough water for everybody and not causing conflicts.
You are listening to Dr. Matt Rodell from NASA on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about exciting new science showing how the world's fresh water supply is changing and what that means for the future. Matt, your study organized data from the GRACE satellite system and the other resources you mentioned in the period from 2002 to 2016. Then with these other resources, you created projections of changes to those water supplies by the year 2080 and onward. But you picked the worst-case scenario from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the 8.5 pathway. Why did you do that?
Well, it didn't really make a whole lot of difference which one we chose. The important thing was looking at the patterns. The patterns are a bit clearer in the 8.5 scenario, which is the high-end global warming scenario. It's easier to see this sort of wet gets wetter, dry gets dry pattern. That same pattern is visible even in the low-end scenario, but the important thing here was just to look at the correlation between what we see in the GRACE data and what these climate models predict.
Aside from the drought and hard times, dry times we've talked about, are there parts of the world where there will be more water, and can that also be a problem?
Well, as you know, it's always a problem when there's too much water, there can be flooding. So there are parts of the world where maybe they don't want to get more rainfall or snowfall each year, and these are probably some of the mid to high latitude regions that already have sufficient amounts of water. And, you know, it doesn't mean that we can just move water around the world. As you know, and a lot of countries chafe at the idea of building pipes to move water from one area to another. So it's a problem whether you have too much water or not enough water. And also consider that any sort of change in temperature or in the amount of rainfall or when the rainfall comes in a given year is going to affect ecosystems, which cannot respond, cannot necessarily adapt as quickly as human beings can.
We recently discovered in some science that white convicts settled in Australia during a fortunate, plentiful period for water. How confident are you about water changes that could show up that take centuries?
Well, right now, you know, we're relying on independent data, precipitation data and data on the irrigation, data on the changes in lake levels, and ground-based data that show where water is being used in what ways to sort of help us to extend or forecast what will happen in the future. But, you know, any forecast is subject to a lot of uncertainty, whether it's forecasting the stock market or the weather or whatever it is. So when we see a change that's associated with something like pumping groundwater out of the ground, you know, unless people make a change and stop pumping so much water, it's pretty reliable prediction that they're going to continue to deplete that water. But in other cases, you know, if we're looking at a change that might be associated with climate change, those are much more difficult to say with confidence that they're going to stick.
Speaking of Australia, this paper says that after a phenomenal drought there, where farming in the Murray-Darling Basin was almost given up, and I covered that, there was a rebound and, quote, so much water stored on the continent in 2012 that the global mean sea level temporarily declined. That's amazing to me. Sea levels around the world went down because of water that was stored in Australia. I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, that was some big news, and it, I have to say it was mostly Australia, but there were some other areas in South America and Africa that also gained water that contributed to that. But yes, if you look at the time series of water stored on the land and compare that with a time series of sea level change, you'll see that they're basically one is the opposite of the other, and that's because about half of sea level change is associated with water losses from the land. Most of that is the movement of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets. They're both slipping into the ocean slowly and helping to fill the ocean. But when you have a massive increase in water anywhere in the land, that can temporarily cause sea level change to decelerate or in fact, to change direction temporarily.
And your team finds several parts of the world are on, quote, a perilous path. Could you just take a couple of minutes, Matt, to give us a couple of examples of where and why?
Yeah, some of these are areas we've discussed already. So Central Valley of California, they are using more water over the longer period than is being replenished naturally. Same thing in the Southern High Plains Aquifer in the central U.S., which is, you know, the breadbasket of the U.S. The decline of that aquifer has been documented for over 60 years. Other parts of the world include the North China Plain, other areas of China, and in the Middle East and southern Russia in that area. The whole region from Saudi Arabia north up into southwestern Russia has been experiencing a decline in terrestrial water storage, and that's really related to two things. One is they've had drier than normal years recently. The other thing is that they're more and more dependent on water from aquifers, and that water recharges very slowly. So if they increase their water usage from an aquifer to irrigate crops, then naturally there's going to be a long-term decline, and it's not a sustainable situation.
Matt, some scientists are calling for geoengineering research, especially blocking sunlight to cool Earth down, and others worry solar radiation management could disturb rainfall patterns and maybe the water storage we're talking about. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, Earth is a complex system, and you need to be very, very careful and really understand when you try to make one change to the system, don't expect that it's only going to change the thing that you're interested in. Probably there are other things that are connected, and you could end up doing more harm than good. So that's something that I would say requires a lot more study before anyone gets serious about it.
And you just gave us some exciting news that the GRACE satellite program will keep going. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, so GRACE, the original GRACE launched in March of 2002. It was originally supposed to be a five-year mission, but we were lucky that it lasted for 15 years, and finally the mission ended in 2017. At the same time, NASA and our German partners had been preparing new satellites to launch to continue this important record of terrestrial water storage observations. The new mission is called GRACE Follow-On, and it launched on May 22nd from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. So far, signs are that everything's working nominally, which is code speak for everything looks great. And we hope that over the next 4 to 6 months or so, we will start to see data coming out of the GRACE follow-on mission that will allow us to evaluate the results of this paper and also, you know, make new forecasts and use it for new uses.
Two quick questions to finish up. Thing one, what the heck is hydrometeorology?
Well, hydro means water. Meteorology is weather. It's what's happening with water in over the short periods of weather, really. So it's not as complicated as it sounds.
Okay. Thing two, your paper comes with a fabulous color map where we can look at the hidden water wealth of the world, and I will put a link to your new paper, Emerging Trends in Global Freshwater Availability, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And that paper is free to anyone. It's published in the journal Nature, May 16, 2018. But how can ordinary people follow what you're doing here?
Well, if you go to grace.jpl.nasa.gov, that's sort of the starting off point for finding information on the GRACE and GRACE follow-on missions. There's a wealth of information there on recent research accomplishments related to GRACE, what's going on with the missions, and some nice color charts and other educational materials.
We'll check it out. From Maryland, we've been speaking with Dr. Matthew Rodell. He's the leader of the Hydrological Sciences Lab at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. Matt, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.